This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres appealed to Sudan's warring factions to observe a three-day ceasefire over the Muslim Eid al-Fitr holiday on Thursday.
I am deeply concerned about the terrible toll on civilians, the appalling humanitarian situation, and the horrifying prospects of further escalation.
He spoke as a rival force, the rival forces, battled for a sixth day. Gunfire could be heard in Khartoum, where the fiercest battles are being fought. As thousands of civilians tried to flee the area, the violent power struggle has killed hundreds so far and is tripling the tipping, that is, a nation reliant on food into what the United Nations calls a humanitarian catastrophe. The United States said it was sending more troops to the region in the event that it decided to evacuate its embassy in Khartoum. The AP's Sagar Magani picks up that part of the story.
Two Biden administration officials say the planning began earlier this week as fighting rages between two warring factions in Sudan. An embassy convoy was attacked in the capital. The officials say the Pentagon's moving military assets to a Navy base in Djibouti. The Defense Department says it will send more capabilities to the region to potentially help facilitate an evacuation of embassy personnel. The violence so far has kept the State Department from requiring staffers to leave the country, with Khartoum's airport non-functional and its roads treacherous even during peacetime. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Myanmar's Supreme Court reportedly said Wednesday that it will hear appeals by ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi of her convictions for corruption, election fraud, and violations of state secret laws. Suu Kyi was arrested back in February of 2021. This is VOA News. President Joe Biden will formally announce his 2024 re-election campaign as soon as next week. That's according to three people who have been briefed on the discussions and spoke to the Associated Press on the condition of anonymity to discuss internal deliberation. Now, they say they're not aware of a final decision on timing has been made, but they say Biden had been eyeing next Tuesday for 4 years to the day since the Democrats entered the 2020 race. Biden has repeatedly said he intends to run for a second term, but advisers say he has felt little need to jump into campaigning because he faces no significant opposition to his party's nomination. Uganda President Yoweri Museveni, declined to sign a bill that would require the death penalty for homosexuality in some cases and send it back to the parliament for so-called strengthening. Museveni's decision was announced late Thursday after he met with lawmakers in his ruling National Resistance Movement Party, almost all of whom supported the bill. In other news, Twitter has started removing blue checks, users who don't pay. We get more from the AP's Ed Donahue.
The blue check mark helps verify the user's identity to distinguish them from fakes. Since Elon Musk bought Twitter, he's talked about charging for the blue check. After several false starts, Twitter has started removing it from those who aren't paying for it. The cost of keeping the marks range from $8 a month for individual web users to a starting price of $1,000 a month to verify an organization. Since Musk took over, Twitter does not actually verify the individual accounts to ensure they are who they are. Some high-profile users no longer have the blue check, including Beyonce, Pope Francis, and former President Donald Trump. Seinfeld actor Jason Alexander pledged to leave the platform if Elon Musk takes away his blue check. I'm Ed Donahue.
Large parts of the Muslim world are preparing to celebrate the end of the fasting month of Ramadan and the start of the holiday Eid al-Fitr. But the festivities are overshadowed in many parts of the region by conflict and tragedy. In Sudan, the joy of the coming holiday has been eclipsed by violent battles between the army and its rival paramilitary force, despite an attempted ceasefire that have killed hundreds of people. And in Yemen, a stampede at a Ramadan charity killed at least 78 people. For more news, we invite you to join us at our website, that is voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Today is Friday, April 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, President Biden orders the military to prepare options to evacuate Americans in Sudan as fighting escalates.
The officials say the Pentagon's moving military assets to a Navy base in Djibouti. The Defense Department says it will send more capabilities to the region to potentially help facilitate an evacuation of embassy personnel.
NATO's chief visits Ukraine for the first time since Russia invaded more than a year ago.
The visit has sparked a strong reaction from the Kremlin, which clearly warns that Ukraine must not be allowed to join NATO.
And a prisoner's release is marking a first step towards ending the war in Yemen. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned.
Two Biden administration officials say the planning began.
The Pentagon is getting ready for a possible evacuation of the U.S. embassy in Sudan. Forces commanded by two previously allied leaders of Sudan's ruling council began a violent power struggle last weekend that has so far killed more than 330 people, tipping a nation reliant on food aid into what the United Nations calls a humanitarian catastrophe. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Two Biden administration officials say the planning began earlier this week as fighting rages between two warring factions in Sudan. An embassy convoy was attacked in the capital. The officials say the Pentagon's moving military assets to a Navy base in Djibouti. The Defense Department says it will send more capabilities to the region to potentially help facilitate an evacuation of embassy personnel. The violence so far has kept the State Department from requiring staffers to leave the country, with Khartoum's airport non-functional and its roads treacherous even during peacetime. Sagar Magani at the White House.
On the eve of the end of Ramadan, fighting continues in Sudan for a sixth day in a row with no end in sight. It's a catastrophe, analysts tell VOA, as parties fail to observe mutually agreed ceasefire and continues to ignore calls from around the world for an immediate cessation of hostilities. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo has this report from Nairobi.
It's been 6 days and fighting in Sudan rages on with no end in sight. None of the recently declared ceasefires have worked so far. After multiple tries this week due to lack of electricity, we were able to reach Hamad Haj, a former professor at the University of Khartoum, who spoke to us the day after the first 24-hour ceasefire expired.
Relatively speaking, the last 3 days were really miserable. It was a real war. But today, I think it is becoming on both fighting groups. Succeeded to put a kind of a ceasefire for 1 day, although it is still holding, but with a sporadic fight going in the area of the Khartoum official or sovereign part, which includes the National Palace and the military headquarters.
We lost the phone connection several times during the interview, but eventually he describes what he and his family have been going through.
I was living in an area in the northern part of Bundurban, and that was only about 8 kilometers away from the military base of Wadi Seyeda. Wadi Seyeda is a huge military area or district, so the fighting was really very heavy and caused the stray type of bullets were even reaching us in our homes, unfortunately killing 2 persons. Neighborhood, we have to withdraw from that area, and we came to our family Al-Mahdiya Thawra. Since that time, we are safe as a family. We needed to acquire some water and some food rations. But since, as I said yesterday, local sellers and vendors were starting to move around within the area.
The fighting that started last weekend between the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces has killed hundreds, injured thousands, and has left many trapped and unable to access basic health care, not just in the capital, Khartoum, but in other places as well, Doctors Without Borders told VOA. Kenyan President Samuel Ruto broke his silence and addressed the nation on Wednesday evening, saying his country was concerned.
Kenya is deeply alarmed that a misunderstanding over a single outstanding item in the political framework agreement, namely the time frame for the integration of the rapid support forces, into the Sudan Armed Forces has degenerated into violent conflict.
Ruto implored the leadership of both fighting parties to ensure full compliance with the resolution of the Intergovernmental Authority for Development, or IGAD, Heads of State's Emergency Summit held last Sunday, which included an immediate cessation of hostilities and
allowing unrestricted humanitarian access and extending full cooperation to the IGAD Heads of State mission when it visits Khartoum.
Ruto and two other leaders from the IGAD bloc, Salva Kiir and Omar Gele, are slated to visit Khartoum to mediate the crisis. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, Mariama. NATO's chief has visited Ukraine for the first time since Russia invaded more than a year ago. Associated Press correspondent Karin Chamas reports.
A highly symbolic visit from NATO Secretary-General Jens Stoltenberg underscores the alliance's commitment to helping Kyiv defend itself. Stoltenberg confirmed NATO's support for Ukraine in a news conference with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
Ukraine's rightful place is in NATO.
The visit has sparked a strong reaction from the Kremlin, which clearly warned that Ukraine must not be allowed to join NATO. One of Russia's regular justifications for going to war in Ukraine has been the expansion of the military alliance towards its borders, including fears that Kyiv would be admitted. I'm Karen Chamas.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin met with his Swedish counterpart outside Stockholm Wednesday, a rare visit intended to show Washington's support for Sweden's bid to join NATO. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Barb is traveling with the secretary and has this report from a Swedish naval base.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin watches Swedish military demonstrations aboard a sleek corvette warship in the Baltic Sea, the first visit to Sweden by a U.S. defense secretary in more than two decades. The rising interest in Swedish military might, intended as a show of American support for Sweden's accession to NATO.
And to be clear, we look forward to that to happen before the summit in July. So we encourage our allies, Turkey and Hungary, to ratify Sweden's accession as soon as possible.
Swedish Defense Minister Pål Jonson said the country would only grow stronger as part of the alliance.
Sweden feels more secure now after we became invitee to NATO. And we think that we can provide the alliance with strategic depth and make it also better and more effective ways also in order to show deterrence and defense, not at least when it comes to the Baltic states and then Finland.
Sweden has military caves and a myriad of islands scattered across the Baltic Sea, important assets for defending NATO allies in the region should an adversary like Russia attack.
So if that ever came to such a scenario, you'd want the NATO alliance to have the upper hand in the Baltic Sea. And for that reason, Sweden's, you know, position is central.
Sweden and neighboring Finland, which became a NATO member earlier this month, asked to join the alliance after watching Russia's brutal invasion of Ukraine. Analysts say Russia hoped to fracture the alliance, but NATO allies and partners who hope to soon become allies say the alliance is stronger than ever. Carla Babb, VOA News, Moscow Naval Base, Sweden.
France is trying to limit the diplomatic fallout after President Emmanuel Macron said Europe should reduce its dependency on the U.S. and avoid, quote, getting caught up in crises that are not ours, unquote, after a state visit to China earlier this month. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
French President Emmanuel Macron travelled to Beijing seeking China's help in ending Russia's invasion of Ukraine. That commitment was not forthcoming. But Macron later wrote on Twitter, "Long live the friendship between China and France." China described the visit as successful and rewarding. Just days later, the Chinese military conducted live fire exercises encircling Taiwan, which Beijing claims as part of its territory. On his return home, Macron said Europe must formulate its own China policy, rather than following the path of its transatlantic ally, the United States.
La France est pour le statu quo à Taiwan.
France is for the status quo in Taiwan, Macron said. France supports the One China policy and the search for a peaceful settlement of the situation. This is, moreover, the position of the Europeans, and it is a position which has always been compatible with the role of ally. But it is precisely here that I insist on the importance of strategic autonomy. Being allies does not mean being a vassal. Those comments triggered a backlash, especially in Eastern Europe. The Czech foreign minister responded, saying strong transatlantic relations are the foundation of Europe's security. Macron's timing was unwise, says former French ambassador to the US, Gérard Araud, now with the Atlantic Council.
We are just right now fighting, all of us together, behind the Americans. We are fighting the Russian aggression in Ukraine. And I do understand that for a lot of our partners, it was not the right moment, frankly, to raise the issue of our transatlantic alliance.
Critics say Macron's comments risk undermining that alliance. Council on Foreign Relations fellow Liana Fix.
Because it confirmed Chinese thinking that it is possible to drive a wedge between the United States and Europe.
In the wake of the brewing diplomatic storm, a delegation from the French Parliament visited Taiwan last week to reassure them of French support. Amid Russia's war on Ukraine and rising tensions between the West and China, some argue Macron is trying to avert wider confrontation. Lancaster University senior lecturer Renaud Foucault.
China is asking for a multilateral world, and Macron is coming and say, okay, if you don't arm Russia, we can be friends and claim that we are not a vassal to the US. We can claim that we are all different blocs, that we have our own sensitivities towards the One China policy or Taiwan and all those things.
The 2024 US election could see a president less keen than Joe Biden to defend Europe. Again, the Atlantic Council's Gérard Araud.
I think that the debate will be reopened by force. The Europeans who want to sleep under the American flag will be obliged to wake up.
Meanwhile, analysts say Britain's so-called AUKUS alliance with Australia and the United States would likely draw London into any confrontation in the Indo-Pacific. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
In other news, Twitter CEO Elon Musk kept to his words on Thursday in removing the blue checkmark verification from numerous social media accounts, which has not paid a monthly fee to keep it. Numerous high-profile accounts, including Pope Francis, Bill Gates, former US President Donald J. Trump, Kim Kardashian, Lady Gaga, and more, lost their blue verification checkmark. However, Barack Obama, who has the most followers after Musk, with 132.8 million, retained his, as did Taylor Swift, Ellen DeGeneres, and Britney Spears, among others. It was not clear whether everyone who kept their blue tick had paid for it. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Yemen's complex 8-year conflict has given the poorest Arab nation one of the world's worst human rights crises, but observers now say a prisoner release is marking a first step towards ending the war. For VOA, Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
Saudi Arabia intervened militarily against the Iran-backed Shiite Houthi rebels in 2015, hoping to reinstate Yemen's internationally recognized government, which the militants had ousted. But continued Houthi missile and drone attacks on Saudi territory, along with economic ambitions to turn Saudi Arabia into a premier tourism and logistical hub by 2030, have made Riyadh want to exit the Yemen conflict. Chinese broker talks between Saudi Arabia and Iran may be providing a way out. Helen Lackner is a former visiting fellow at the European Council for Foreign Relations and author of several books on Yemen, including Yemen in Crisis, winner of the Grand Prix of Literary Associations 2018 in the research category. Lackner tells VOA that the welcome start of prisoner exchanges is separate from the Saudi Houthi negotiations about the long-term settlement to the conflict. She refers to the internationally recognized government as the IRG.
The release of prisoners is excellent news. We still have more than 10,000 waiting to be released. The likelihood of a deal between the Saudis and the Houthis in some form or other, possibly with the signatures of the IRG, is extremely high in the reasonably close future. But that is not the solution to the Yemeni political crisis and, to some extent, the military crisis. And, of course, the humanitarian crisis will not be that significantly changed by such a deal.
Analysts warn there may be continued fighting among the Yemenis because the Houthis, as the strongest force in the country, may have little incentive to seek an inclusive peace and will likely try to control all of Yemen. If negotiations in their current form succeed, they won't lead to a durable peace because the Saudis will have granted de facto recognition to the Houthis while excluding other parties. Abdelghani El-Iryani, a senior researcher at the Sana'a Center for Strategic Studies, told the Christian Science Monitor. Lackner says that if the internationally recognized government is made to sign the deal, they will sign it because they have no options. Also, the influence of the Emirati-backed Southern Transitional Council is likely to decrease considerably, she says. But there are other military and separatist factions present in Yemen who also oppose the Houthis. Analysts, including Lackner, say there are ordinary Yemenis who are terrified of a potential Houthi rule, likening them to the Afghan Taliban.
It's going to be a nightmare, but they are the strongest element now. And Yemenis have every right to be most concerned. Although one would like to say that it will be nice to not have any fighting, if they reach the deal, they will definitely stop attacking the Saudis. That's the easy bit.
Analysts also argue that fighting from the war accounts for a smaller proportion of Yemeni deaths than from the Saudi blockade on the country. They are skeptical of whether the proper groundwork has been laid for a truly comprehensive peace agreement. Del Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
Young pro-democracy activists rocked Thailand in 2020. With exclusive calls for the military to leave power and for the monarchy to operate under the constitution. Many have been charged, jailed, or bailed for their demands, and activists say the May 14th election may be a final chance to reset the country on a democratic path. For VOA, Vijitra Duangdi has more from Bangkok.
The road to Thailand's elections on May 14 has been punishing for the kingdom's young pro-democracy activists. This group has been vilified by conservative royalists and hit with dozens of charges, most seriously for allegedly defaming the monarchy, Thailand's apex institution. A conviction carries a minimum jail term of 3 years. In a country where royalist generals refuse to leave power, youth-led protests since 2020 have opened up debate on equality, freedom, and the distribution of power. But the personal cost has been high. Pro-democracy activist Pasarawali Mai Thanakit Wibunpon says there have been many changes in her life since she became an activist. She says she is constantly being followed by the authorities and faces 15 criminal charges now, three of them for alleged royal defamation. Pro-democrats say the May election is a vital chance to reclaim power after nearly a decade of slow growth and slumping freedoms under the government of Prayut Chan-o-cha, who led a military coup in 2014. Prayut and fellow general Prawit Wongsuwan are the main leaders of a conservative bloc, but they're unlikely to win a clear majority of the 500 elected seats in the lower house. Instead, they're counting on seats from other conservative parties and the 250 senators they appointed to reach a majority and a shortcut back to power. In Thailand's electoral system, the most popular party does not earn the right to govern automatically, but activists say they're still hopeful. Activist Pasarawali Mai Thanakit Wibunpon says this is one of the most important elections in her lifetime, and she hopes it will be free and fair so that the people will get to decide their own destiny. But there is still the ever-present threat of a coup. The army has seized power 13 times since 1932. Parties linked to self-exiled billionaire Thaksin Shinawat have twice fallen victims to coups, the last in 2014. Pathongthan Shinawat, Thaksin's 36-year-old daughter, a candidate for premier from the Pheutai Party, says their popularity with the poor will win them the landslide needed to check the general's return. But Thailand's cycle of elections, coups, and protests may not yet be over. For Rung, a 22-year-old pro-democracy activist, change is coming. The question is, when? Wichitra Dungdi for VOA News, Bangkok.
If you are in Sudan witnessing events taking place there, or if you have family you are talking to there, you can call us on WhatsApp and let us know how things are going there. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. The number again, the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including a standoff between President Joe Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy over the nation's finances that escalated this week, with the White House blasting the speaker as he turned to the New York Stock Exchange to pitch his debt ceiling plan. We'll examine this story and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Chinedu in Washington. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Alexis de Tocqueville, the 19th century French diplomat, political philosopher, and historian, once said that media is how we maintain civilization, noted USAID Administrator Samantha Power recently. That is high praise, she said, and speaks to the indispensability of the media. And she stressed that independent media is facing existential challenges at the moment. One of them is a direct onslaught from autocrats.
Autocrats target independent media because information empowers us. This is not, as they say, a bug. This is a design feature of repressive rule. And whether people are resisting an invasion, whether they are campaigning to replace corrupt leaders with reformers, taking on climate change, collective action really cannot begin without a collective understanding of the challenges and opportunities in front of us.
What's noteworthy and maybe gets a little bit less attention, said Administrator Power, is that for all of the declining indicators among human rights and civil liberties tracked by the research group Freedom House, freedom of the media and freedom of expression have declined the most.
In the past 17 years, the number of countries that have a score of 0 out of 4 on the media freedom indicator has more than doubled, from 14 to 33. And again, that aligns with the 17 straight years of freedom in decline. Powerful people who seek to control the narrative spread inaccurate information to drown out the truth. They silence journalists.
The second existential challenge to independent media is a financial health crisis resulting from a rapidly transforming media environment. The United States is partnering with fellow democracies to try to recognize these two distinct challenges and come up with tools to address them, said Samantha Power. For one, USAID is partnering with Microsoft, Internews, and companies and organizations to launch a public-private partnership to help small media companies transition to an online subscription basis to help make these outlets viable, even profitable. Then there are corrupt and repressive actors who use protracted lawsuits to drive small, underfunded, independent media outlets out of business. To help such outlets defend themselves and continue publishing even while under attack, USAID and its partners have founded Reporters Shield, a pooled public insurance fund intended to defend reporters and NGOs from legal threats meant to silence criticism. I want to use this occasion as a call to action for anyone who finds this intriguing, said Administrator Power, and would like you to get involved or to join.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.